This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
I'm Margaret Flinter.
Margaret, we celebrate our one-year anniversary this week here on Conversations. And looking back, it's been quite a run. I remember our first guest was Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. She was going to call in at 2:30, and guess what? There was nobody here to record her that day, but as it turned out, she didn't call in for about another hour, and our radio producers showed up. So those were some of the early beginnings of it, but we've had a great run. We've had wonderful people, very dynamic speakers. Todd Park comes to mind, who's just enthusiastic about fusing data and technology to improve America's healthcare, and certainly Dr. Brent James out at Intermountain Healthcare, a great model of quality and efficiency.
Well, we've certainly had a front row seat by talking to some of the most interesting thinkers in healthcare today. And it has been a very exciting year with all the pre and post health reform drama, to say nothing of the actual legislation that we now have. And yet, Mark, I was thinking this morning, nothing happens in a vacuum. We can't look back at the first year of Conversations and celebrate health reform without also being very aware of the lagging economy, how many people are out of work, the environmental disaster in Louisiana, and an ever-increasing partisanship divide both in D.C. and, it seems, across the country, which makes me think it's a very good thing. There's so much cause for optimism when I look at the next generation, including that freshman class that just rolled into town and campus here at Wesleyan University.
And thanks to health reform, they can stay on their parents' insurance policy till they're age 26, but hopefully they're gainfully employed and making the transformations that our country needs. Let's take a minute to point out some of the other benefits, though, that the reform legislation has, and we'll be getting to roll out. A central feature of the bill was the Patient's Bill of Rights, prohibiting insurers from setting lifetime limits on coverage, banning insurance companies from denying coverage based on pre-existing conditions, preventing insurers from dropping coverage after patients get sick, and requiring plans to cover comprehensive preventative services. These five provisions take effect September 23rd.
And the new figures released by the Census Bureau in its annual report support the need for these changes. The census is showing that the percentage of people living in the United States without health insurance rose to 16.7% in 2009. Now, that's the highest rate since the Census Bureau began collecting data in 1987, and certainly goes along with the increased demand that we're seeing for primary care by the uninsured.
Well, lawmakers and interest groups took the figures as an opportunity to argue the law. Democrats and the like are for expanding government and employer-sponsored health reform. Republicans say that they have a better plan in mind. There's still a lot of confusion and unknowns about what the plan is going to do, especially if Republicans win control of the Congress.
Well, we'll be hearing much more about this in the coming months. But let's turn now to our interview with today's guest, Dr. James Weinstein, director of the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. He's also the president of the Dartmouth Hitchcock Clinic and the co-founder of the new Dartmouth Center for the Science of Healthcare Delivery. Dartmouth has made important contributions to health reform and innovation. It's best known, perhaps, the Dartmouth Atlas Project. And we'll be talking with Dr. Weinstein about that and also about much more.
We're happy you can join us today. But no matter what the story, you can hear all of our shows on our website, chcradio.com. You can subscribe to iTunes to get our show regularly downloaded, or if you'd like to hang on to our every word and read a transcript of one of our shows, come visit us at chcradio.com. You can become a fan of Conversations on Healthcare on Facebook and also follow us on Twitter. We're also happy to announce that Connecticut Station WNHU 88.7 FM in West Haven will broadcast our show on Mondays at 2 p.m.
And as always, if you have feedback, email us at chcradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. Now, before we speak with Dr. Weinstein, let's check in with our producer, Lauren Bonner, for the headline news.
I'm Lauren Bonner with this week's headline news. Newly released figures from the Census Bureau are proving to be a prime opportunity for the Obama administration to sell the health care bill and tout some of the new benefits that kick in this week. The percentage of people living in the U.S. without health insurance rose to 16.7% in 2009, the highest rate since the Census Bureau began collecting data in 1987, according to the report released last Thursday. Health Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, in an interview on C-SPAN, says that the economy has taken a huge toll on uninsured Americans, and she says this underscores how important the bill was to enact this year.
I think it makes it more important than ever that we rebuild this market. There's some provisions in place to stabilize the current market, to provide some help to employers and to early retiree plans, to keep coverage in place, and then a new market by 2014.
As a series of tough insurance restrictions go into effect September 23rd for new health plans, the Obama administration will use every platform available to communicate them. An end to arbitrary rescissions, lifetime limits on coverage and pre-existing conditions for kids among them. Hundreds of events across the country are being organized to mark the six-month anniversary of the law. Following Secretary Sebelius' declaration last week of zero tolerance for insurers falsely blaming premium increases for 2011 on the patient protections in the Affordable Care Act, several Senate Democrats sent letters to five insurance companies warning them against telling consumers their rates are going up because of the new mandates in the healthcare law. State regulators have said that some insurers seem to be guessing at the additional costs. The most closely watched legal challenge facing the healthcare law went before a federal judge in Florida last week. 20 states and an influential small business group are challenging the constitutionality of the mandate over coverage. Judge Robert Vinson indicated that he would allow parts of the lawsuit to proceed, which parts are not yet specified. The hearings and oral argument on the motion for summary judgment will be held December 16th. This week on Conversations on Healthcare, we're looking at how academic research has influenced healthcare reform. Dartmouth College has been a leader on this front, most notably with its findings from the Dartmouth Atlas Project, which maps geographic variations in care and cost for Medicare recipients across the country. A new report from the Dartmouth Atlas may be worth considering as we move toward a healthcare delivery system focused on primary care. The findings in the Dartmouth report show that neither higher amounts of primary care services nor making sure patients routinely see a primary care clinician is by itself a guarantee that a patient will get recommended care or better outcomes. The research also finds that patients' access to primary care, the quality of overall care, and the likelihood of hospitalization vary greatly in different locations. In other words, where patients live has a greater influence on the care they receive than the color of their skin. The authors of the report note that despite the importance of primary care, access is not enough to guarantee high-quality care. Achieving this requires better coordination between specialists and hospitals. If you want to check out or download the new report, go to our show webpage, chcradio.com. Let's turn now to our interview with Dr. James Weinstein, who can tell us more about how Dartmouth is reforming and innovating healthcare delivery.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Dr. James Weinstein, director of the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice, home to the Dartmouth Atlas. He's also president of the Dartmouth Hitchcock Clinic and co-founder of the new Dartmouth Center for the Science of Healthcare Delivery. Welcome. Dartmouth College has been a leader in the healthcare reform and innovation, in particular with research that has stemmed from the Dartmouth Atlas, a set of studies that maps geographic variations in how U.S. regions and cities vary in care and cost for Medicare recipients. What role in advancing or informing healthcare reform has the Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practices, home to the Atlas, played?
I think it's been significant, Mark. The Dartmouth Atlas work that Jack Winberg started back in the 1970s has really shined a light on this idea of variation in practice. It's really enigmatic, meaning it's really puzzling to people that think that healthcare knows exactly what it's doing, and if you go to your doctor, that they're the best doctor, and you get the best care. And you know, I think the work of the Dartmouth Atlas really says that's not true. It's hard to grab that because people have great faith in the health profession, as I think they should, but it's an industry that hasn't had the measurement and the feedback at a public level in a transparent way.
Well, Dr. Weinstein, it certainly was clear during the debates on health reform that the findings of the Atlas really became quite influential. And we understand that the New Yorker article written by Dr. Atul Gawande that heavily referenced the Atlas findings even became required reading for the White House during the debate. And as a result, I understand the administration has promised to ask the Institute of Medicine to consider ways of putting the findings into action in some way, and that one suggested method is to actually set payment rates that would reward efficient hospitals, hospitals that really had a handle on this cost-care balance. What's the status of putting this into action, and what do you see as, I'm sure there's some big challenges there, but what do you see as the challenges and obstacles to using the findings to really drive change?
Living in both worlds, as I do as a researcher and running a hospital system, I understand the complexities of actually trying to make reality out of what the Institute shows and puts forward. I don't know that there's really any obstacles. I think what the Institute of Medicine's challenge will be to say, what is value-based medicine? And then, of course, when there's money involved, it's always sensitive, or politics involved. It's sensitive about how that affects me or my state. And we know that from the Dartmouth Atlas that, for example, there's a, you know, 2.5-fold difference across the United States in just rates of reimbursement by Medicare. Is that really fair? And some people would say, well, it costs more to live in my state. But these things are adjusted for cost in states. The hope is that the Dartmouth Atlas will at least be core information that has shined a light on where we have opportunities, and that the Institute of Medicine, with great minds, will use that information in ways to try to lay out strategies around what we hope will become a value-based payment system.
You co-founded with President Kim the new Dartmouth Center for the Science of Healthcare Delivery, which promises, I think, to bring some real new energy into identifying strategies for healthcare transformation. What's the mission of the new center, and can you share with our listeners some of the initial priority projects for the center?
I think at Dartmouth, with Dr. Winberg, we've invented and started the evaluative sciences and looked at, you know, national data through the Dartmouth Atlas. But there's not been the science of healthcare delivery. We know about the genes, we know about the drugs, we know about the variation. How do we actually implement the change in a healthcare system more broadly? Dr. Kim and I believe that this is really an opportunity for the nation, much like the National Cancer Centers that were started years ago that took on the tremendous problem of cancer in our nation. And we would like to see 40 centers of healthcare delivery science across the country, supported by federal dollars, at least in part, to start to take on how do we actually deliver the best diabetic care? How do we actually deliver the best breast cancer care? If we have one diabetic program that really works nationally from Utah with Brent James, why aren't we doing that nationally as a nation? Well, you know, Dr. Kim is famous for his work outside the United States in tuberculosis and AIDS, where people said, you know, you can't treat drug-resistant TB, etc. The fact of the matter is that Paul Farmer and Jim did that in countries with a lot less resources than we have, mm-hmm. and a lot cheaper. We actually believe that we should take the lessons from those kinds of work that Jim and Paul did and bring them to the United States. Things don't have to cost a lot of money to do well. Let's do the case studies and see how we do that in the United States for the best price, the most efficient way, and replicate that across the country.
Well, that is a very exciting, thrilling, I would say, agenda, and we look forward to participating in some of that with you. And thank you for mentioning Dr. Brent James, because I was just about to mention him to you. Dr. James, the Chief Quality Officer at Intermountain Healthcare, is someone that we've spoken to about putting into practice shared decision-making. And you, of course, founded, I believe, the first in the country Center for Shared Decision-Making back in 1999. And as Dr. James shared with our listeners, the benefits of shared decision making, which involves presenting patients with the pros and the cons of all the viable choices of treatments, really promises a new level of involving patients in their healthcare decision making. How do you see this model evolving across the country? And in particular, we're curious, are you seeing it carried into the area of end-of-life care, which certainly was an incredibly galvanizing issue throughout the healthcare reform debates?
My belief in opening that center in 1999 was that we haven't had the right people involved in decisions of healthcare all the time, and specifically the patient. It should be about the patient and their beliefs and their values. And what we've learned over the years in many, many studies now, where patients are well informed by an independent source without conflict, patients make really good decisions about their health care and oftentimes choose the less invasive, just effective treatment as opposed to the more expensive and maybe not as effective treatment. Of course, doctors talk to their patients, but the notion that we've actually studied this for years now and found that about 30% of patients on average, when given this kind of independent information, make a different decision than they do if they're just talking to their doctor, makes me think, and the reason why we started this center, that there's tremendous opportunity here. What's the solution? The doctors are worried about taking away their autonomy. People are worried about reimbursements. The end-of-life issues you mentioned, people are worried that people are going to keep them from having the treatments that they need to sustain their life for a longer period of time, when in fact, when they're well informed, they would choose not to die in a hospital. They would choose to be home with their loved ones. They would choose not to be in an intensive care unit having multiple tests to prolong their life for a matter of weeks to months, as opposed to being with their loved ones and dying at home. End of life is a very expensive part of our healthcare system, and it's not just dollars and cents. It's what it does to families and their loved ones. We need to allow patients to share in these decisions about things that matter to them most, their health.
Today we're speaking with Dr. James Weinstein, Director of the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice, President of the Dartmouth Hitchcock Clinic, and co-founder of the new Dartmouth Center for the Science Healthcare Delivery. I should also note, since you were talking about spinal surgery, that you were also the founder of the Spine Center at Dartmouth Hitchcock. You know, a few weeks ago, we were talking with Dr. Fitzhugh Mullen about our country's effort to train the next generation of healthcare providers to meet the evolving demands of the American population. He spoke about the many new innovations in medical education. Can you tell us what's new at Dartmouth around training the next generation? And are you seeing a difference in the focus of new medical students, and maybe juxtapose that against your own days as a student?
Mark, I think the notion of training the next generation of physicians is extremely challenging, but extremely exciting. There's so much to know today in medicine. The breadth and depth of knowledge is growing exponentially compared to when I was a medical student. And yet, at Dartmouth, I think we're really excited about what we're going to be doing in that domain. We're going to be looking at maybe a prolonged undergraduate experience and a different medical school experience. We believe the liberal arts are extremely important. We believe that we haven't taken advantage, as I was suggesting before in our new Center for Healthcare Delivery, that we haven't taken advantage of the engineering sciences, the business school sciences. We're going to look for students who have a passion to change the world, and we're going to empower them with curricula that not just focus on the traditional basic sciences and clinical science, but it's not enough to understand the mechanisms of the scientific cycles of the cells, or what drugs and how they work, but how do we actually use shared decision making with patients in a clinical practice? What kind of electronic health record systems need to be in place to help the patient through this maze of healthcare that patients often get overwhelmed with? How do we engage their families and their communities?
Well, Dr. Weinstein, I think one way in which you're already making a great contribution, particularly to people already out there practicing in the field, whether in primary care or in the hospital, is through the green books on clinical microsystem redesign. Now, that might not be a familiar term to a lot of people, but these are a series of workbooks that provide, as you say, tools and methods that busy clinical teams can use to improve the quality of and the value of patient care, as well as the work life of the staff who contribute to that care. And I thought the comment on your website was particularly important. It says, absent the intelligent and dedicated improvement work by all staff in all units, quality, efficiency, and pride in work will not be made or sustained. So the workbooks sound like just that, practical primers in how people practicing today make and sustain change. Can you just share with us a little bit about how you see the Green Book helping practices to provide exceptional care, and are you helping them measure that improvement as well?
Absolutely, Margaret. The work by Paul Batalden and Gene Nelson and Mark Splain and others in our organization have really been leaders nationally in this notion of microsystem change, where we actually bring to bear all of the disciplines to manage a patient's care. People need to work at the top of their license, whether it's a nurse, secretary, a nurse practitioner, a physician, etc., to coordinate the care for that patient in the most effective, efficient way. And the Green Book asks people to understand their work within the context of a whole in the management and to streamline that work to become the most highly valued, low-cost delivery system.
Dr. Weinstein, you have a great global view of the healthcare transformations going on. What do you see in terms of innovations, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
One of the things I wanted to mention about a program that Dr. Kim and myself are hoping that will begin in July of 2011 here at Dartmouth is very exciting. Dartmouth, for the first time in its history, will offer a distance learning degree from Dartmouth College in healthcare delivery science. It will be a synchronous and asynchronous learning experience, meaning that meaning that participants in the program will visit campus four times during an 18-month period, but most of the learning will occur back in their home state, their home city, their home country. This will be an international project, which we will provide the tools and the knowledge that we've learned over the years to try to spread it nationally.
Today, we've been speaking with Dr. James Weinstein, director of the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice, president of the Dartmouth Hitchcock Clinic, and co-founder of the new Dartmouth Center for the Science of Healthcare Delivery. Dr. Weinstein, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. This week's bright idea focuses on a new project to combat obesity in several cities across the United States. Armed with the new findings from a study that links community violence with obesity rates and other chronic illnesses, the Prevention Institute has partnered with local organizations in six of the most at-risk cities in the country: Chula Vista, California; Denver, Colorado; Detroit, Michigan; Louisville, Kentucky; and Oakland, California, as well as Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, are part of a six-month pilot project starting January 2011. The project is run by the Oakland-based Prevention Institute and is aimed at improving community health through violence prevention by encouraging collaboration from many community partners, ensuring adequate funding for initiatives, and developing a multifaceted plan with the goal of creating safe spaces and promoting community development and social cohesion. Reducing violence in these communities will help make them healthier places to live in a variety of ways. When residents feel safe in their neighborhood, they're more likely to spend time outdoors and exercise regularly, which further improves neighborhood safety and health. In addition to facilitating physical activity, reduced crime rates will also attract new businesses to the area, including the full-service groceries that many of these communities lack. Residents' access to fresh fruits and vegetables they need to keep their family healthy will expand due to the increased number of local grocery stores and the reduced anxiety residents feel when walking through their neighborhoods to the local store. To find out more information about this project, go to preventioninstitute.org. By working to improve neighborhood safety, this pilot project will make regular exercise and healthy diet a realistic option for residents. And these crucial lifestyle changes will go a long way to reducing obesity in cities across the country. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.